by thanking the organizers for inviting me to this wonderful workshop, and the Perimeter Institute for the generous hosting of this workshop. So I'd like to start by first correcting Bob's historical account of my life.
Which you just stole me.
I managed to distort anyway. I didn't actually get my PhD at Chicago. I followed my advisor and ended up getting my PhD at Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And then I did a postdoc at Salt Lake City, University of Utah. And there I got converted into a computer scientist. And so that's part of my discrete evolution. So anyway, a lot of you have been presenting lots of heavyweight mathematics, heavyweight category theory in particular. Those of you who know me know that I don't really like category theory at all. I only do it when it's absolutely forced on me. I'd much rather be thinking about, you know, binary quadratic forms and stuff like that. But category theory ends up showing up inevitably in these things. Anyway, so I will try and be as elementary as possible. So when I was asked to give this talk, I gave Bob the option of the latest and greatest stuff that I was doing, or some old, more conceptual work. And he said, nobody's interested in channel capacities here. So I said, all right. So I searched in my past light cone and found on some ancient parchment this, these slides, which is what I'm going to now present to you. So you will find this talk was actually first given at Imperial College in 2001. When Ross Duncan was only 4 years old, and five, okay, sorry. and I find quite interestingly that many people have started worrying about causal structure and integrating causal structure and space-time issues into quantum mechanics again. So I think that's entered in an exciting new phase. So it's perhaps apropos to go back to some of these elementary ideas. Okay, so you will find as a result some of the terminology which I've used, some of the old slides, some I've remade, you'll find perhaps some of the terminology a bit quaint. Okay, so as I said, this is joint work with Richard Blute and Ivan Ivanov, so if there's anything wrong, please complain to them. and it's also ongoing work with Rick and Ivan, and also Alessio Guglielmi and Lutz Strasburger, where we are trying to connect all this stuff up to a very exciting logic called BV. I have no idea what BV stands for, but nobody does. All right. the motivation for this was an early paper we saw by Fotini Markopoulou on causal evolution, I think the late 1990s. And we were also motivated at that time by a desire to modify the consistent history framework to work on posets rather than on sequences. Okay, so what's the basic challenge here? You want to capture causality. So causality is limited to the light cone. No superluminal communication should be possible. And however, you do not want to make it so local that you don't capture the non-local features of quantum mechanics, namely things like entanglement. So how do we guarantee causality automatically while yet allowing non-locality? Right, so I will lead you through some elementary examples to illustrate what the problems are. So what I mean by guaranteeing causality automatically is I don't want you to stare into the details of the theory, study the commutation relations, and conclude that things are actually causal in the end, but rather formulate it in such a way that it's manifestly causal. Okay, so we're going to take causal structure to be a partial order between events. So perhaps this is another time for an anecdote break. So when I switched from physics to computer science, I was very excited. At first, I thought computer science was going to be this trivial business involving writing Fortran programs, because that's what they tell you computer science is when you're a physics student. But I saw a thesis by Glenn Winskill called Events in Computation, and I saw all this beautiful mathematics there about causal structure, which really appealed to me, being trained originally as a relativist. So there's this remarkable convergence of ideas in computer science and in physics on causal structure, and contributions from both sides have been important. So in this point of view, a causal structure, and that's why it's discrete, is just a partial order between events. Okay, so here I've displayed some events, and I've displayed the causal relations through these arrows. Okay, so what's important then is that I'm thinking of discrete spacetimes, a discrete web of events. I'm not really worrying about how it's embedded in an underlying continuum. And so here is a picture of some events and also some slices. Okay, so slices are just anti-chains, so sets of points that are not related by the causal relation. Now, just as there's a causality relation between the events, the weight balance requires this, okay, between the events, there's also induced a causality relation between the edges. So I will sort of talk about a causal precedence relation between edges as well as between events. In fact, I'll more often be talking about edges than events. And slices are just anti-chains, i.e. sets of edges such that no two are related by the causal relation. How observant. So yes, slices are sets of edges. So that's a slice. That's a slice. But that is not a slice. Right? Good. Very good, Peter. So slices play an important role. They are, roughly speaking, the where you specify data so that you can talk about the subsequent evolution of information. So here is a maximal slice. Right? You see it cannot be extended without becoming not a slice. And now there are some orders one can impose on anti-chains. So here is something which seems not to have a name. It's one half of a relationship called the Egli-Milner ordering, but it's not fair to call it either Egli or Milner, because it's not as if each of them came up with one half of the relation. So, right, so what does it say? So it says the anti-chain X, and perhaps I'll start saying slice henceforth, precedes Y if for everything in the lower in the lower set, there's something up there above it. Okay? So in this case, you have these three slices that I've displayed, X, Y, and Z, and X is below both Y and Z, but Y and Z, I believe, are not related. Right? Is that right? Yes. So Y and Z are not related by this order. The lower ordering. Yes, but perhaps I can call it the four ordering or the lower ordering. Very good. Yes, this is, in fact, the lower ordering for those of you familiar with power domains. So as I said, many of these ideas evolved in computer science and in physics in analogous ways. So in fact, to continue with another anecdote break, after being in computer science for almost 16 or 17 years, I discovered this thing called the internet, and you could you could track down your old friends who you had lost track of in previous decades. And one of the people I tracked down was Raphael Sorkin, who, when I was a graduate student at Chicago, there were these two bright young postdocs, Raphael Sorkin and Abhay Sticker. So Raphael was a good friend of mine from those days, but I hadn't seen him for 15 years. And I found that he had started working on something called causal sex. And by pure serendipity, I had entered a subject that involved domains. And so I discovered Raphael was dangerously close to reinventing domain theory. So I, or in fact, had already made significant steps towards doing that. So we reconnected. And that's how we got involved in this project. So there's another order on anti-chains that's relevant here. So this is the Egli-Milner ordering. So it involves the precedence order I had before, as well as now the dual condition on the other side. Okay, so now for everything in the upper set, you insist that there's something in the lower set from which it came. Okay? This is a very good order on maximal slices, because it really sort of lays out how they are related. And not necessarily the best order for what I'm doing in this paper, though a very good order for various purposes. So let me show you the interplay between these different orders. So here are some slices and a set of events. And these slices have names, X, Y, Y prime. Okay, so this ordering is called the Egli-Milner ordering. So what's evident from this picture is that X precedes y, or x is lower than y in the lower ordering. And also, in this case, in the Egli-Milner ordering. Okay? So for everything up there, there's something down here below it. However, if I extend this y to y prime, you see there are edges there that don't have anything below it that comes from x. So y prime is above x in the lower ordering, but not in the Egli-Milner ordering. Okay, so this is really illustrates the difference. The Egli-Milner ordering doesn't let you go out and grab other events like that. Okay, so another thing that we realized while working on this was that cosets are not enough. You really need to understand how physical effects flow through the system. So we need not just cosets, but actual graphs that tell you, roughly speaking, what are the channels of information flow. So I receded to an older technology to make this slide. So here is another web of events with some edges between them, some of which I've shown in red. And you will see that the ones in red are ones that I wouldn't have bothered to draw in if I were merely talking about a poset. Those are kind of additional edges that I'm now explicitly putting in to say there was, in fact, a direct communication between these two points in addition to the sort of induced causal connection that propagates through the poset order. Okay, so you actually have not just posets, but directed acyclic graphs. Okay, so those red lines would not be necessary. Okay, so here's a diagram that I'm going to show you that illustrates one of the two points about making sure that causality is enforced. So being dyslexic, I drew the N backwards. So here's a so-called N diagram. And it just has four events with one causal link this way, but we don't have the corresponding link that way, right? So I guess this is actually a Cyrillic letter of some kind. Anyway, so here I've given names to the edges because it's going to be the edges that are going to be relevant. And I've named the slices according just as a list of edges that occur in that slice. So here's the slice AB, and I'm going to push it through. And there's another slice CDE, and there's a third slice FG. And these are perhaps the three slices that I'm choosing on which to describe all the information and how they evolve. So this, as you can see, I've actually chosen maximal slices all the way. And perhaps I should say my theory should be formulated on maximal slices. Now, if I do that, if I just say I'm going to take all this information here, whatever it is, some kind of density matrix for the system as it existed here, propagate it to the whatever density matrix I need to describe the composite system there, and finally up to FG, I will have no way of ensuring that this does not influence C. And as you can see, there's no causal link going from this edge B to the edge C or to the edge F. Perhaps if I look at the actual details of the physical evolution, I will see that there isn't. But a priori, I won't know that there isn't a causal effect propagating like that. Right? And if you look at, you know, standard treatments of quantum field theory, you have to fiddle around with this commutation or anti-commutation relations and see that things at space-like intervals really do commute. The theory is formulated typically in the Schwinger formalism on maximal slices. So this was one of the examples that Fortini had in her paper motivating why this was a not so obvious thing how to do. So of course, I have a bad habit of saying what's about to appear on the slide. So one reaction to this could be to say, I'm only going to keep track of things, information on the single edges. I'm not going to put these global slices in there that may allow a causal effects to creep into the theory, right? So if we propagate only along edges, I've called them local slices here, but I literally just mean edges, then I just keep track of a density matrix for this edge A, one for B, a separate one for C, and so forth. I may not, in that formalism, keep track of the fact that there are correlations between these two. Okay, I will have deliberately thrown away the non-local information that tells you that B and C perhaps are an entangled pair. Okay, so going on these strictly local slices is also not a good idea. So this example was pointed out to us by Raphael, who found an early draft of this paper on the kitchen table when he was visiting. So, right, so I'm going to try and identify a class of slices that turn out to be just the right ones for which the propagation works and is guaranteed to be causal. Okay, so that's the main contribution of this paper. So evolution occurs as follows. You imagine observers, and I don't mean observers in the sense of people really sitting there and interacting with the system, but just imagine that they are on the edges and there is some density matrix describing what's on the edges. Okay, so at vertices is where action happens. So either you can have an ordinary quantum evolution, i.e. a unitary, or there's some kind of interaction either with another quantum system or perhaps there's a measurement of some kind, or it can happen that the system breaks up into subsystems that fly apart. Okay, so things can come together or fly apart. And we have to describe all these things by appropriate mathematical gadgets attached to those vertices. Okay, so we know how to do unitary evolutions of density matrices. We know how to do measurements. So as you can see, this was at a time when we thought POVMs were novel things. When you have a system breaking up and you want to keep track of what's of only part of the subsystem, of course, you trace. And then when you have systems coming together, you tensor them. All right, so what are the slices for which the theory works well and is guaranteed to be causal and is not so not so local as to lose non-local correlation? So these are what are called locative slices. Now, this is a very silly name. We made up this name when we were in a silly mood. but anyway, we have stuck with this name, locative slices. Think of them as being sufficiently, but not too much, localized. So so let me try and define them inductively. So you fix any subset of incoming edges. So this is going to be part of my inductive definition. So any subset of incoming edges presumed not to be entangled or interacting in any way. So these always form a slice. Supposing you have a slice and you have a vertex such that the incoming edges of that vertex are all in the slice. We call slices are sets of edges that are pairwise acausal. Okay, so supposing I have a vertex such that all its incoming edges happen to be part of that slice. Then I can sort of describe what it means to propagate a slice through a vertex as follows. I delete all the incoming edges and I add in all the outgoing edges. And it's easy to check that you always get a slice doing this. If you start with a slice and you carry out this operation, you will still get an anti-chain. So it is the slice obtained by propagating S through V. All right, so here's the picture. The blue slice is what I have before I propagate. Okay, so it's a slice. There's the vertex that I've targeted for propagation. The incoming edges, B and D, are both included in my slice S, right? And so I delete them from S. I'll have A and G still included. And then I will throw in the outgoing edges from V, and I get the new slice, okay, which is shown in red here. Okay, so that's the idea of propagating a slice through a vertex. So a locative slice is defined inductively. Any subset of the incoming edges is said to be locative. And if S is a locative slice and V is a vertex with this property, all its incoming edges are included in S, then the slice obtained by propagating S through V is indeed locative. So what's so great about these locative slices? Why pick them out? So the point is, if you're interested in the density matrix on a slice and you keep track of it only on locative slices, then you can do it without ever computing partial traces. So these are exactly the slices for which you never have to trace anything out. Okay, so information is not lost. Gosh, this is one of those quaint slides, a review of POVMs, which I think I will skip this, right? So, right, this is another quaint slide. So at that time, we were reading a paper by Asher Perez, on intervention operators, where this was one of the motivational papers for considering super operators. So now, of course, we're used to calling these intervention operators super operators, right? So they correspond to possibly discarding part of the system when you're making an observation. So this is the most general thing you can do when you're interacting with the system. Okay. So what are we going to do? We're going to propagate density matrices on these locative slices. So each edge, or more generally, each slice has associated with it a density matrix. And in a given family of slices, each vertex has associated with it an intervention operator or super operator. Okay, so let's look at this picture, and perhaps I should also redraw this, because I will need to refer back to it. And I have the two sets of slices, looking for colored chalk in the Dixie cup. Aha. Okay, so there's the red slice, or the red slicing, I should say, and also a green slicing where one like this, and then like that. Okay. So what's going to happen is that associated with every vertex in a particular slicing is an intervention operator. But this might change from slicing to slicing, but in essentially a trivial way. It has to be padded out with the appropriate identities. So let me just illustrate that in this simple case. So if I propagate through P1 over there, then I've got something that takes me from density matrices on the Hilbert space associated with the system on A to density matrices on the tensor product of the Hilbert space associated with B and C. If I propagate through T2 using the red slice, so then you see I'm here, and I have to sort of push it past this while keeping this one fixed. And what happens is that. Okay, so this has basically got an identity action on the HC, but it has to be padded out that way. So the types actually look different. If I were to use the other slicing, and then I'd have had to get to the green slice first already, but once I'm there, then if I propagate through T2, you see something of slightly different type. But the important point is that they just padded out with appropriate identity operators, tensored with appropriate identity operators. So, so to speak, the real action is to transform this B piece to this D piece. But it does show that the slicing becomes relevant, and ultimately one has to make sure that things are slicing independent. So the summary of our proposal, so we actually have two proposals for how a causal theory should be formulated, is to work with DAGs, not just posets. Keep track of these density matrices, put super operators at the vertices, and keep track of the density matrices on these special locative slices. So you evolve along locative slices, and now if I want to know what's the density matrix on a particular edge, I first compute the density matrix on the minimal locative slice containing that edge, and then only I take the appropriate partial traces. Okay, so minimal locative slice. That's a key feature of this way of doing it. Okay, so the first thing we have to argue is that things will work out in to be slicing independent. So let's say I have this color is supposed to be orange. I don't know, but at least it's visibly colored. I have a slice L, and then I have two choices. I have these two vertices, U and V, which are, so to speak, minimal. So every time I'm saying minimal now, I mean in one of those orders that I talked before. So when I say minimal locative slice, I mean in the lower ordering. And when I say a vertex that is sort of minimal above a slice, I mean in the causal ordering. So U and V are both minimal, above the slice L. And I have the choice of either pushing L through V, getting the slice L sub V, or pushing it through U and getting the slice L sub U. The point is that these two guys have to be acausal with respect to each other if they're going to be minimal. So then I can push these things through in either order and get up to LUV. And the important point is that the intervention operators at space-like related vertices must commute. It will turn out not to matter in which order you did these things. Okay, so that's essentially the beginning of an argument for slicing independence. Okay, so less colorfully, it looks like this. So as I said before, you can either go through U or through V to get to LUV. These are going to be the same because the the operators at U and V will commute because they're space-like. And the important point, a kind of calculation that is very familiar to computer scientists, you piece together such diamonds inductively to show full slicing independence. Yes, yes, of course, right. Yes, that's why I said piecing diamonds together, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so to obtain the density matrix on an edge or any slice, you evolve along locative slices up to the unique minimal locative slice containing that edge, and then project down to E using the appropriate partial traces. We know this is independent of the slicing now. And the important point is the fact that it's minimal is what guarantees that you've prevented things from sort of creeping in from the outside. Okay, there's another proposal, which is you say you evolve, and by a different rule that I will spell out presently, along locative slices, up to any locative slice, not necessarily a minimal one, containing E, and then project using partial traces. However, how you evolve is slightly different. You have to do different things according to whether an event is to the past of an edge or not. Roughly speaking, if things are to the past, you take their effect into account. But if they're not, then you kind of sum over all the possible outcomes associated with something that's acausal. Okay, so so this is, of course, explicitly building causality into the evolution prescription. So the point is these two things are going to turn out to be the same. Okay, so why does this first proposal about using minimal locative slices guarantee that you are causal? So let's look at this edge E. If you look at the minimal locative slice containing E, you can prove that you get below that slice only vertices that are to the causal past of this edge. Okay, so that's an easy lemma to prove. And we get all of them. Okay, so if you had more of them, it wouldn't be minimal. And if you didn't have all of them, it wouldn't be locative. Okay, so you can actually show that as an easy lemma. So this is kind of the basic intuition why that first proposal guarantees causal propagation. So here's a very simple scenario just to illustrate the second approach. So imagine that we have some density matrix coming in here. Let's say it then breaks up into two pieces. So actually, nothing really exciting happens here. Let's say we have just an entangled pair, and then over here a measurement is made, and it turns out that the spin of the particle is up. So T is the thing that says I measured the spin and I found it to be up. Okay, so important to see what this thing does should not affect that, right? Okay, so so I'm looking at the density matrices. For brevity, I'm writing it as a state like that and taking the density matrix. So the density matrix on the slice BC is really the same as what it was on A. At B, you have to trace over C. Okay, so since that's the least That's the least locative slice containing d. Okay, so at t, we measure the spin of the second subsystem and find it to be up. So, of course, the effect of that is to just project onto the spin up. So if you do that to rho bd, you'll get this. Now, bd is not the minimal locative slice for b, and if we attempt to now say, oh, yes, well, you just trace over d and see what you get that, which is absolutely not right. Okay? So what you need to do is to sum over all the possible outcomes of this measurement, since b is causally independent of the intervention at t and cannot be influenced by that outcome. So you have to actually sum over both possible projections. Okay, so now you indeed get the right answer, and the two coincide. So what this is saying is that when you compute the density matrix using variance of the intervention operators, you do two different things. So if the vertex is to the causal path, you just apply whatever it is. But if it's not to the causal path, you sum over the possible outcomes. Okay? And so now, of course, the causality is explicit in the evolution condition. We'd like to show that this is actually the same as what we had before. So the proof of that proceeds as follows. Again, I only want to give you an intuition for the proof. So the idea is that if you look at vertices not to the path of E, they can be systematically peeled off, essentially first by using commutativity to move them outermost, and then using the cyclic property of trace to rewrite them as that, and then using the POVM identity. So basically, by peeling off successively, you reduce from your arbitrarily locative slice to a minimal one, and you get rid of all the guys that are not explicitly to the path, and you're left exactly with the ones only that are only to the path. So this calculation shows, indeed, these two things are exactly the same. So tracing over all the possible outcomes is exactly the same as pretending they're not there. Okay, so how much time do I have left, Bob? 15. Ah, okay, so I think I'm going to end early. So as I told you, I'm not going to talk about categories at all. but these are not categories. So if you try to give a categorical picture of what's going on here, then you see that the those boxes that I had, or vertices that I had, you can think of them as what are called polymorphisms in a poly category. I know it makes me sound a bit like a parrot, but everything here is a poly version of ordinary category theory. So you have these so-called polymorphisms connect not just a single object to a single object, but a list of objects to a list of objects. Okay, so you may have a situation like this. So this is the polymorphism. These are the lists of objects to which they are connected. So I think yesterday we implicitly saw multi-categories in Danny Lehman's talk, and now we're seeing poly-categories, which are which have things on lists on both sides. There's a well-known book on categorical logic called Introduction to Higher Order Categorical Logic by Lambeck and Scott. And for the last 15 or 20 years, Phil Scott has been avoiding trying to write Introduction to Higher Order Polycategorical Logic, which Lambeck wants to write with him. So any monoidal category can actually be viewed as a polycategory. But this polycategory viewpoint emphasizes the relationship to deductive systems. So I'm not saying anything about a rather complex ongoing development connecting all this to a certain kind of logic. But I also find that this polycategory view meshes sort of immediately with the pictures that we had before.
Yes, I believe so. Rick is the poly expert.
In linear logic, you don't get tensors.
That's right. So, yes. So, certainly not
every situation looks like this. So, you could have pars on the left, on the right. That side is right. Yes, pars on the right. So, in fact, originally we were quite excited about the possibility of different logical connectives capturing how entangled things were. And I'm still excited about it. Okay, as I said, this is or as Rick said, this is a degenerate example. In polycategories, the comma on the right of an arrow may be a par, as in linear logic. I don't know if anybody has talked extensively about linear logic yet, but I know Ivan is planning to blow you away with some heady brew of linear logic and von Neumann algebra. So, right. Now, you can have a sort of freely generated polycategory from a DAG. So each edge becomes an object, each edge of the DAG, and each vertex becomes a polymorphism. So you can define a kind of free polycategory generated by a DAG, and then one imposes nice closure conditions and other algebraic conditions that I don't want to spell out, mainly because I don't remember what they are. And any questions about these things can be addressed right to Rick, who, as I said, is the poly expert. Okay, so there's also, so here's the kind of picture that we were setting up. On the one hand is this very, let's say, even, it's not exactly kinematical, but you can think of it in that spirit, this almost geometrical kind of structure, which is the poly category generated from the DAG. It's capturing the shape of how things evolve. And the actual dynamics, how the density matrices evolve, is going to happen in another category, and there will be a polyfunctor connecting the two. Okay. Like a baby version of PQFT, so to speak. All right, so so here we have to describe that other category, which is going to be the target of the dynamical polyfunctor. So that category is called conj. So objects are finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And a morphism is actually a finite family of maps. These are basically to allow us to have non-trivial super operators. There are probably more modern ways of doing this today. Okay, so you have two sort of finite families of these linear maps, and you compose them by forming all combinations in the right order. But how do they actually act? So so of course, when you have a category, you don't really necessarily need the objects to be sets of some kind and the morphisms to be functions on them. But so let me just say, the objects are really, in some sense, just labeled by the Hilbert spaces. They're really the collection of density matrices on that Hilbert space. And a morphism in conj basically acts like that, where this is the family, M-index family of finite family of functions. Of linear maps. So we have to restrict the class of morphisms so that the conjugation is trace preserving. And this category is called supops. Okay? and the associated polycategory that you build from it, we call P of supops. So dynamics now is what is called a polyfunctor. I'm not giving precise definitions for things like polyfunctor. I mean, it's not just the adding the prefix poly, but but I think it's better not to give precise definitions of things in poly categories. So the evolution of density matrices is given by rules for calculating them on locative slices, given the density matrices on earlier locative slices. And a polyfunctor gives exactly such a correspondence. So by the way, it's important to keep in mind that there's sort of two kinds of things going on in a polyfunctor. It's sort of propagating things forwards, but also gluing things together sort of horizontally. And both things have to be nicely preserved and associative and so forth. So I was not sure of what phrase to stick in here, because polyfunctors are not monoidal, but are in essence employed with morally monoidal. And thus polyfunctoriality effectively says that one has indeed slicing invariance. Or perhaps one should say slicing invariance is part of the proof that you have polyfunctoriality. Okay, so let me wrap up. So locativity captures exactly the slices needed to guarantee causal evolution. Let me say a few words about the work currently underway. We have a paper that was supposed to have been completed a week ago, which I guess will be completed next week. So there is a way of presenting all this as a kind of deductive system. So what you do is that you view the edges as atomic propositions in some logic. The slices are then formulas. joined together by some connective, perhaps. Vertices then describe inferences in this logic. And you want to set it all up so that the locative slices are exactly the deducible formulas. So it turns out this is a not just a trivial exercise. There are subtleties happening when you when you have induced entanglement. Okay, so the logical connectives that emerge are supposed to capture whether the edges are entangled or guaranteed to be independent. And there's right now some discussion between us about whether it means they're definitely entangled or definitely not entangled. And as I said, there are subtleties that arise with induced correlations. And finally, there's some work that those of you who were at the student session yesterday may have heard about. We haven't dealt with beam splitting experiments in this situation. So if you have a beam coming into an interferometer and you get the two things coming out, that's not a case of a tensor product. That's not a case of a system being decomposed into two independent pieces, not at all. And something quite different is necessary. Some kind of additivity thing is going on, not necessarily just by putting plus into the category, but we have seen more subtle ways of capturing additivity concepts. And so this is possibly an interesting area to work on. So as I said, there are, this is quite an old talk. I said 8 years ago now, and so before we learned about all the exciting developments with the Dagger compact categories and the even more exciting things happening on the horizon with HUFTs and so forth. So I thought it might be useful to go into some of the early ideas by which we were thinking about incorporating causal structure into the quantum mechanical framework. Okay, thanks.
I wondered pretty early on, you had this condition that what said, yeah, I look at incoming edges, but I assume that those are not entangled.
Yes.
Is this where those subtleties that are here at last level arise if you can't guarantee something like this?
No, no, that's not the reason for the subtleties. So there's those subtleties that happen with this locative slice stuff. The subtleties happen when we try to capture this with a logic.
Yeah.
Which perhaps is saying that most logical formalisms are too local in some sense. And indeed, it turns out that the logic that we originally tried didn't work except with some hacks, or what Vic called brilliant insights and I call hacks. but the new version that we're trying to work with uses a formalism called deep inference, which allows you to go deep inside a term and mess with things. So maybe that's got the kind of non-locality you need. Anyway, so I think the picture is something. Remember the picture? Is it?
I could do that.
Anyway, so I think it's something like this. You have some kind of cross connection like that. And what happens is that entanglement kind of gets induced from one slice to the other. And then it's hard to capture that in the logic.
Yes.
What?
So usually in the deployed categories, you can only compose along one edge at a time, right? Is that what you're doing here?
Exactly.
Yes, so it's like the cut rule in logic.
So you're not using multicut, and you're not using
No, definitely not using multicut. So multicut is an invitation to disaster, yes.
It's an invitation to compactness.
Right.
Right, which is why we don't want compactness in this thing.
Yes, compactness is a fantastic thing for all the work that has been done in categorical quantum mechanics. I think it's really... It was very insightful of the original workers to see the role of compactness. But I think the interplay with causal structure is something else. In fact, there you don't want compactness. So indeed, I think you're finding in your work that there's this subtle interplay between compactness locally and not globally. Yeah.
So... is the maybe so is there Curry Howard like isomorphism for poly categories on some sort of deep inference type of logic?
Rick says yes.
The problem is it'll be built into the definition when the definition is sorted out completely. So the answer will be yes soon, I would hope.
Oh, you're working on that.
Yeah.
So deep inference is good after all, but there's a lot of criticism.
Yeah, I love deep inference. I never understood why people were so passionately against it. I mean, I can understand there's criticism of it, but there are people who feel that go around saying, burn the witches, you know, like, and I don't see any reason for that.
Burn the frogs in that case.
Any more questions, comments? Okay, then thanks, Steve, again.